Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's always nice to come down out of the mountains to the tropics here. It seems really warm to us. It's in the 50s. Well, you've heard the long of it. Now it's time for the short of it. We always like to kid each other about our, you know, on average, we're average height. We got to kid each other, Dan's my friend, so. Well, my message is like a continuation of his. I actually have enough time because I have one point to make. As Dan said, the just shall live by faith. Our journey to the kingdom of God has been likened to Israel's journey out of Egypt to the promised land. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that journey. You know, we look back on the whole picture. You know, we look back on it as history. So we see it all at the same time. And we can look at them and go, well, wow, they sure lacked faith. But we weren't there when it was happening. You know, we didn't travel with them and experience the things that they experienced when they experienced them. You know, they left Egypt with a high hand. They were happy, you know, free at last. They were on their way to the promised land, a land flowing with milk and honey, high expectations. And what happened? Well, it soon changed. Let's turn to Exodus 14. Because this is a little bit like, you know, say we were slaves in Washington and we were delivered from our slavery and we're going to go to California, the land flowing with milk and honey. And God leads us to the Olympic Peninsula. And it's like, well, wait a minute. So let's start reading verse 1 of Exodus 14. It said, the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, that they turn and encamp before Pihahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, over against Baal-Zephon. Before it you shall encamp by the sea. So we're going over, camping by the sea. And Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are entangled in the land, the wilderness has shut them in. So Pharaoh looks at what's going on and he says, well, those guys obviously don't know their geography because they're over there trapped on the Olympic Peninsula. You know, they're between the mountains and the sea and they can't go anywhere. Verse 4, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will follow after them, and I will be honored upon Pharaoh and upon his host, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. And it was told the king of Egypt that the people fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, why have we done this, that we've let Israel go from serving us? And he made ready his chariots and took his people with him. He took 600 chosen chariots and all the chariots of Egypt and captains over every one of them. And Pharaoh hardened the heart of, or the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued after the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with a high hand. In verse 9, but the Egyptians pursued after them all the horses and chariots and his horsemen, his army, and overtook them encamping by the sea between these two places. So, it's like we go to the Olympic Peninsula, and all of a sudden, you know, the King of Washington says, well, wait a minute, and sends everybody from, you know, the military over, sends a bunch of tanks, you know, and a bunch of personnel carriers and all this stuff, and they go after us. And, you know, how does that look, you know, from our perspective? You know, not knowing, you know, not having read the history, you know, and the same as the children of Israel here. They're going, oh, wait a minute. You know, here we are trapped. Here's the army coming after us. This is just not working out. In verse 10, he said, when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore have you dealt with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we did tell you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness. So that was the physical reaction to what physically was happening to them. You know, it's like, what are we going to do? You know, physically speaking, we're here, trapped between the mountains and the sea. Pharaoh's army is coming after us, the most powerful army in the world at that time, and they're just going to slaughter us. They're going to come after us with chariots, you know, which were extremely feared at that time. You know, just like if we were on the Olympic Peninsula and a bunch of, you know, Abrams tanks and armored personnel carriers are coming after us and a few helicopter gunships, and what chance do we have? No chance. So physically, it was a no-win situation. There was just no way that they could get out of that. But what did God do, though? You know, in their case, of course, he led them through the Red Sea. You know, they had no way of knowing that would happen physically. It's just like if we were on the Olympic Peninsula and all of a sudden all the salmon gather together and we just walk across the Hood Canal on a bunch of salmon. And then when the tanks come, the salmon swim away, you know. You just don't expect that kind of thing. So it looked absolutely hopeless. You know, the physical circumstances of that looked absolutely hopeless. But God delivered them in a way that they would never have imagined. In Daniel 3, there's the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And basically, it's the same type of thing, where Nebuchadnezzar had set up this huge image, and everyone was supposed to worship the image. And they said, we're not going to do it. You know, we serve the living God. We're not going to do it. So the king brought them before, you know, this fiery furnace, which was the means of their execution, and said, hey, you know, I'll tell you what. If you just worship the image, I'll forget this whole thing. You can go back to your positions. And they said, nope. And the king was enraged, you know, and heated the furnace even hotter. And not only that, he actually threw them in. But they were delivered from that by going through that experience, even though it totally looked hopeless. And then in Daniel 6, basically the same type of thing happens to Daniel. You know, he's, you know, they outlaw praying to any other god, and Daniel just keeps on doing what he does. He's going to pray three times a day, and so these guys that conspired against him had him arrested, and the king made a decree, so even though the king didn't want to, he had to throw him in the lion's den, but the lions didn't touch him. So even though it looked hopeless, he was delivered from that. Even what Dan talked about, Abraham, You know, when he was 75, things were a little different back then, but still, when he was 75, God told him, you're going to have a son. And then the way it worked out, as Dan was talking, waited till he was 99. And Sarah, his wife, was old as well. You know, when the angel came and told him she was going to have a son, she just laughed. She says, yeah, right. But yet, that's the way it worked out. You know, we as humans desperately want to live by sight. We would so like to know what's going to happen. But yet we have to live by faith. It's interesting the way things work out. I mean, in our own lives, there's a couple of examples in the congregation here. You know, Matt Schaefer lost basically half of his blood, and maybe even a little more. You know, and that was actually more serious than even was announced from the pulpit here, is that he really should have died, but yet he's still with us. Now, he was here earlier, but he had to leave because Samara wasn't feeling well. But and then those who have been here for, you know, some time know that, you know, my first wife, Sherry, had a heart attack, and then she had triple bypass surgery to repair the damage to her heart. And as a result of that, had a stroke. You know, they always tell you when you have these sort of surgeries that there's a risk of stroke. Well, she had one artery that was totally blocked, so when they bypassed it, some debris, you know, came out, and the first place it goes is to your head. And, you know, basically the doctor came in to me and said, we're sorry. And that was it. We're sorry. You know, no, we're sorry, but she'll be okay. You know, none of that. Just, we're sorry. And the neurologist said that the long-term goal was for her to walk again. But yet 6 weeks later, she could have walked out of the hospital. You have to be wheeled out in a wheelchair. But she could have walked out. And we were leaving, and the doctor came in, and she was actually kind of huffing because she rushed to get there before we left. And she said, I didn't want you to leave before I told you, you know, what a miracle that is. You know, that they recognized that, you know, that was just miraculous. So many times, you know, what we see can look absolutely hopeless, but yet that's not the reality. That's not what God has in mind. Well, I'm actually going to do what Dan probably wouldn't want me to do, because my wife has a little nickname for me, Gloom and Doom Coon, you know? Oh, it's Gloom and Doom Coon, you know? But I'd like to read a couple of things. These are a couple of articles that basically talk about the situation that we are in. And, you know, we live in a time that, you know, we understand that things have to happen for the kingdom of God to come. And we don't necessarily want them to happen. In fact, most of us, you know, would love to have things work out differently. But we're in a time of turmoil, and we can't see our way out of this. But the point is that walking by faith, we don't need to see our way out. It will work out. But I'd like to read a couple of things. And this is just a summary of you know, what's out there. You know, economically, we're working through some tough times. There was an article I read yesterday that said that in China, that 20 million people have lost their jobs in China. 20 million. they feel that worldwide, the job loss through this downturn will be 50 million. Well, that's a lot of people. You know, they're wondering if some governments will survive this. But this is an article, it's entitled September 11th, 2008, America's Economic 9/11. It says, in an admission stunning for its frankness, Representative Paul Kajorski, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, chairman of the House's Capital Markets Subcommittee, recently admitted on C-SPAN that the current economic problems faced by not just the United States, but indeed the entire world, were a result of an electronic run on the bank that resulted in the hemorrhaging of $550 billion in just an hour or two. Speaking the last week of January on the Washington, D.C.-based television program, Representative Kajorski was verbally accosted by an irate American caller, charging that the economic stimulus package currently up for debate in Congress, as well as the previous $700 billion bank bailout, is solely for the benefit of fat cats on Wall Street, rather than for Joe Sixpack on Main Street. With barely concealed panic in his voice, the congressman tried explaining the severity of the current financial problem faced by the U.S. with the following comments. He said, why did we do that? We did that because, look, I was there when the Secretary of Treasury and Chairman of the Federal Reserve came and talked with members of Congress about what was going on. It was about September the 15th. Here's the facts, and we don't even talk about these things. On Thursday at about 11 a.m., the Federal Reserve noticed a tremendous drawdown of money market accounts in the United States to the tune of $550 billion being drawn out in the matter of about an hour or two. The Treasury opened up its window to help, pumped $105 billion into the system, and quickly realized that they could not stem the tide. We were having an electronic run on the banks. They decided to close the operation, close down the money accounts, and announce a guarantee of $250,000 per account so there wouldn't be further panic out there. If they had not done this, their estimation was that by 2 o'clock that afternoon, $5.5 trillion would have been drawn out of the money market system of the United States, which would have collapsed the entire economy of the United States, and within 24 hours, the world economy would have collapsed. We talked about what would happen. It would have been the end of our economic and political system as we know it. And that's why we had to act and do things quickly. Why? Because if you don't have a banking system, you don't have an economy. And although we did that, it wasn't enough. The economy has been falling, and we're really no better off today than we were 3 months ago, as other assets are going sour by the moment. Somebody threw us in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean without a life raft, and we're trying to determine which is the closest shore and whether there's any chance in the world to swim that far. We don't know. Put in less gentle terms, the two-hour, half-a-trillion-dollar, 4.6 billion per minute event Kajorski described was the equivalent of having a major artery ripped open in a way that threatened the very existence of not only the U.S., but the entire world, whose economies and political stability are intrinsically tied to the monetary good mood of the land of the free and the home of the brave. According to some of the economic experts interviewed for this piece, and then in parentheses, who insisted upon anonymity due to the sensitive nature of the topic, it is one of the largest, if not the largest, single transfer of money in history in such a short time frame. Furthermore, the general consensus of those interviewed is that had the bloodletting been permitted to run its course, meaning the evaporation of $5.5 trillion, it would have resulted in the elimination of 90% of America's liquidity. Again, the blood that keeps the economic body alive in just the span of 5 hours. In a word, unprecedented. So that's happened September 11th. just this last fall. So they stepped in and stopped this run on the banks. You know, I said a couple years ago that, you know, the financial system was, you know, kind of a house of cards. And, you know, we had this, you know, bubble that was based on real estate pricing and so forth with all these derivatives, and, you know, the small amount of capital was driving this huge amount of paper debt, you know, and when you eliminate that asset base out of the bottom, it all falls down. So you know, my point in all this is not to scare everybody, but to understand that things can happen rapidly, and what we see is, you know, not, you know, what we base our faith on. Just one more little blurb here. This is actually a letter explaining some emails that were sent out by Jim Sinclair. It says, Jim Sinclair is a precious metals and commodity specialist. So that's the first red flag that goes up. Anybody that's in gold right now, it stands to, you know, profit from fear, shall we say. But still, I thought this was interesting. Some of the highlights of his nearly 50-year career include the founding of Sinclair Group of Companies in 1977, which offered full brokerage services. Mr. Sinclair served as a precious metals advisor to Hunt Oil and the Hunt family for the liquidation of their silver position as a prerequisite for the $1 billion loan arranged by the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker. This probably happened maybe 20 years ago, but the Hunt brothers tried to corner the silver market. I don't know if you remember that, but apparently he oversaw the liquidation of their position in the silver because they failed in their attempt to corner the silver market. They drove the price of silver up to about $20. He's also a general partner and member of the executive committee of two New York Stock Exchange firms and the president of Sinclair Global Clearing Corporation and Global Arbitrage. He's authored numerous magazine articles and three books dealing with a variety of investment subjects. He's a regular speaker at various commodities-related events. In January 2003, Mr. Sinclair launched Jim Sinclair's Mindset, and that's M-I-N-E, because he's dealing with gold and commodities, which now hosts his gold commentary and is intended as a free service to the gold community. And I'm going to drop down. What he did is he sent several emails out to his constituents. He says, "Dear comrades in Golden Arms, I sent you a certain few emails that I consider to be the most important communications issued in my career that started in 1958. And then he lists two of the emails that he sent. One said, "This is it." And the other said, "It is now." This communication is to inform you that as of 2/13/09, it is totally out of control. There is no longer any means of reversal of the beginning of the final phase of the downward spiral now solidly set in motion. For your sake, protect yourselves immediately. Be prepared for disruptions in distribution common to hyperinflation. And then he gives some advice to his people. Now, I'm guessing that his people are a little better off than I am, shall we say, because you'll see by some of the things he suggests that, you know, it's not something that I could or would want to do. He says, "You should have already distanced yourself from your financial agents. If you haven't, you are headed for significant displeasure and strain. Make sure you stay 3 months ahead on necessary items that could experience distribution delays, such as prescribed medicine and preferred foods. Even though real estate is far from a buy, if you could afford a second home outside of major cities, it would serve a good purpose. Then he says, consider that good gold shares of non-U.S. companies incorporated in a non-U.S. country operating in a third country traded on multiple exchanges are a means of money expatriation legally and in broad daylight if required. He gives a couple other things, but they're not, we don't need to hear them. Simply said, as of February 13th, the situation is out of control. The motive was profit, and the degree of disintegration caused in the pursuit of this goal was not anticipated. The key event was when Lehman was flushed. All hell broke loose. The hell cannot be contained in any practical manner. I seek nothing of you but the protection of yourselves. Respectfully yours, Jim. So there are those out there who feel that, you know, this is you know, not going to end well. But I personally feel that, you know, this is going to bring about, this is a global problem. You know, it's not, you know, Japan's in trouble, everybody's in trouble, China's in trouble. There are those who feel this will be, you know, the end of the euro, you know, because some countries are possibly going to pull out of the eurozone because they simply have to. They can't stay within the parameters required to trade with the euro. But this is a global problem, and it, you know, requires a global solution. And the global solution is, you know, global monetary policy, global banking, et cetera, which people have wanted for years. Those who would profit from it, of course. But my point in bringing all of this up is that we live in tumultuous times. And we can't see the end of this. You know, we desperately want to see our way through this, but we simply can't. There's simply too much going on to see our way through. I read an interesting article about, you know, the global community has wanted China to revalue their currency for a long, long time. The reason for that is it's artificially held low to help their export business. Well, what's happening is China is experiencing a severe drought, which is really going to cut into their food production. Well, with a billion plus people, you know, that can be a problem. So what some people see is that they may revalue their currency to make it more valuable, therefore they'll be able to, you know, to buy food at a better price on the world market. And that, of course, affects everyone because, you know, commodities prices went crazy a while back. They've calmed down, you know, right now, but, you know, who knows? So like I say, my point of this is simply to say that we cannot see our way through. You know, we know that God will see us through this whole end time, you know, whatever happens. But I don't think we need to, you know, fear, shall we say, not knowing, or even fear having a worldly, well, a human, shall I say, anticipation or an anxiety about what's happening. Because we can't see it. I think that this crisis we're going through will end up ushering in world government and a world economic system, exactly the kind described in Revelation 13. Things can happen fast. You know, things have happened fast. You know, now is the time to awaken out of sleep, to put our house in order, to concentrate on what is important, really important, which is our relationship with God, and to understand that it is through faith in God that whatever happens will happen to us. We just can't see it. We just can't. So my one point is that we cannot walk by sight. And in the past, if you look at how God has dealt with his people, he leads them through circumstances that look hopeless, they look impossible, but God works it out anyway. So if we see things that look hopeless or look impossible, that really shouldn't affect our faith, because God can do the impossible. And in fact, he seems to enjoy it. So as we see these things happening, you know, as the scripture says, you know, let's look up and look to God, because our salvation draws near.